was just up in Portland a week and a half ago.
Oh, fantastic.
University of Southern Maine for the Muskie Institute. I used to work for Ed Muskie years ago, and I did it for his son, Ned.
Well, that's wonderful. Well, I love the book, now out in paperback, Bobby Kennedy, A Raging Spirit. And I have to ask this, does being the son of Mary Teresa Shields give you a unique understanding into the Kennedy mindset?
You've done your homework, yeah. I keep remembering, trying to remind, is it T.H. Teresa or the other one? My mom was as Irish as you can be. And the funny thing is, we're both, besides the family, I just got my 23andMe. I'm 94% Irish and British. That's so, because they're all entangled. My mom was Irish Catholic, row house Irish. My grandmother on the other side was Protestant, orange woman, like Mrs. Doubtfire. She spoke with an incredible accent. She was an immigrant. That was an interesting mother-in-law relationship there. The two sides of the Irish, the green and the orange. Yeah, she was the real thing. And I think she, the great story in our family was our family was Republican. My dad was certainly. And even though he converted to Catholicism from his Episcopalianism, he voted always Republican. And I sort of had it out with him. I said, how can you vote against Kennedy? He's Catholic. He said, I'm a Republican, which is interesting. And then Mom secretly voted for Jack Kennedy and never told anybody but my younger brother, Jim, and said, never tell your father. So as long as she lived, she never told. This is such, I think it explains why I'm kind of a hybrid. I'm kind of hard to figure something.
Well, it's interesting. You point out in the book that Bobby Kennedy, called Black Robert by his brother Jack, was the son who was the most different of all from his father, Joe.
Well, his father wasn't a nice guy. I mean, I'll just be generous about it and said he wasn't a generous guy. He didn't care for people who had problems. There's that great thing I come up with in the book where one of the family friends said how wonderful it is how generous Bobby is. And how he shares and everything. And the old man says, I don't know where he got that from. It's hardly a tribute from the father to the son. But Bobby cared, maybe because the father called him the runt. How's that for a comment? Because he was shorter than his brothers. And to call him the runt, to a boy especially, I think. I don't think girls like hearing it either. But a boy hearing it with all taller brothers being called the runt. And I think Bobby did find a way of understanding, even though he was born to wealth, what it was like to be overlooked and not being one of the country's chosen people. I mean, he was he knew what it was like to be skipped over.
His work, and you spend a lot of time in the book talking about his work with Senator Joseph McCarthy, and that was certainly complicated, but I thought it was interesting that while he had that familial relationship with Joe McCarthy, who had dated his sister, was a great family friend, it was really the tactics of Roy Cohn that pushed him to the other side.
Yeah, Roy Cohn was an off-putting person. You can see it in his face. I mean, he had a face that was frightening. There's something about that expression he had. He was a conniving bad guy, and but McCarthy loved him. And I think there was some of that rivalry there where Bobby envied the fact that how much McCarthy loved Roy Cohn. Roy Cohn made McCarthy famous. He was helped make him famous. He was a real PR guy who knew how to get headlines, and McCarthy loved headlines. And there was a great scene. It was really right out of the New Testament where Bobby said that that Roy Cohn took McCarthy out over a hill and showed him all the beautiful things. You know, that great scene from the Bible where Jesus was taken out by the devil and told, if you bow out before me, I'll give you the whole world. and that's the way Bobby looked at Roy Cohn, as the devil. He did. I told this to Ethel. She was kind of taken aback by that biblical reference, but it's clear as day what he was saying. And as you suggest, there was a real complication in that. Bobby had tremendous empathy for Joe McCarthy, who was drinking himself to death for years, just drinking and drinking hard liquor and killing himself. And when he finally would go visit him when he was drunk and sit with him. And remember, he put it in his diary once, Bob McCarthy drunk last three hearings. And yet when he was going after the rackets, after Jimmy Hoffa and Giancana and all those horrible guys, McCarthy was very supportive of him, even though he's drunk. He was supporting him. And then when he died, Kathleen told me that his daughter told me that Bobby, her father, was driving in the car to the National Airport, now Reagan Airport, and got the word on the car radio that McCarthy had finally killed himself with booze. And he was so distraught, he drove around the airport three times. And then he went to the funeral and sat in this car so nobody would see he was there.
Right.
Out in Appleton, Wisconsin, for the burial of his friend. I mean, Jack and Teddy both said those, that was the most admirable thing they could say about their brother, is that he stuck personally with Joe McCarthy despite his villainy.
We're talking with Chris Matthews about his book, Bobby Kennedy, A Raging Spirit. You write that after the events of Dallas, Bobby Kennedy's focus changed from fighting against villains to fighting for the victims.
Yeah, I think he, first of all, it's hard for, look, I was affected just as a kid, not a kid, as a college student when Jack was killed. I don't think I ever looked at politics the same way again. And I think a lot of the country my age was affected that way. You never forget where you were, how you felt, everything. And this had nothing to do with politics. I was a young Republican then in those days. It had to do with Root reform. It's finding him fascinating and caring about the guy and wanting to meet him, actually. But Bobby, was his whole life starting in 52, was devoted to his brother. And that's all he thought about, all he did. The Cuban Missile Crisis, the fights over civil rights. It was Bobby fighting at his brother's side as his protector. And he hears on the phone from J. Edgar Hoover that his brother's dead. He just calls up and says, your brother's dead. And he's in shock. And I think he eventually did decide he was going to look out for victims. And he wasn't going to go be quite the terror that he was before against his enemies. Maybe he saw that politics had gotten too violent, too extreme, and he wasn't going to be part of that anymore. I think we all went through it and said, I'm not going to ever be as passionate on one side or the other after that. We said, this has gone too far, this hatred. And even though the crime was committed by a Castro person, a pro-Castro leftist who had become disillusioned with Soviet communism and had fallen in love and become infatuated with Castro, by all evidence, that everybody felt bad about it. And I think Bobby felt the worst, and I think Bobby stopped being so passionate a politician. I don't think he was as much a hater after that. I don't think so.
His run for the presidency is one that he agonized over, especially when Gene McCarthy got in the race, and you write so well about that. And he wasn't a natural campaigner, but he certainly warmed up to it on the trail, and the reaction that people had to him out on the campaign trail was so visceral. What did people see in Bobby Kennedy?
They saw a relic. They saw a living person of the brother who looked enough like him. And one of the great ironies is that when Bobby lay on the floor there at that kitchen of the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles, when he's dying there, he looked more like Jack than ever. I think people, when they saw him starting in Atlantic City at the convention in 64, when he came up on that stage and quoted from Shakespeare, they thought they were seeing Jack back again in a way, but they're seeing his brother. There's nothing like, it's chilling. And there's nothing like in American politics to have a president shot down in his youth, and when he's young and great looking and his wife's gorgeous, and there's all this display of romance, and then to have the brother come back within less than a year later and stand up on the stage in Atlantic City. It just, there's never anything like it, never. And I think people on the Democratic side especially, but not just them, were wowed by him. And I think he was not happy with it. When he would have a big crowd up in New York when he ran for Senate, he'd say to his buddy Paul Corbin, it's not for me, it's for Jack. They're here for Jack. He could tell. But by the end, in 68, they were there for him.
You wrote
it was clear. I mean, after what happened in Indianapolis when Martin Luther King was killed and he walked into a ghetto, we called them in those days, a tough black neighborhood in a big city, and had to tell them that Martin Luther King had been shot by a white guy. And there he is, a white guy, standing among all these African-Americans, and he's telling them that Martin Luther King's just been killed. They didn't know it. In fact, I got the tape from NBC, and he said to the guy next door, asked the guy, do they know yet? And the guy said, no. It's stunning drama. It's like nothing like it. The Bobby's life, anybody else's.
We're in such a time
of a movie, or Lawrence of Arabia, or something. Mm. There's nothing like it. This kind of drama.
we're in such a time of extreme polarization, and certainly the news of the last 24 hours accentuates that even more.
Sure does.
Could a Bobby Kennedy, could somebody like that find a way to somehow bring us together and bridge this gulf that seems greater than ever these days in America?
Well, he tried, and he tried after King was killed, and he tried. And when he's taken to his burial in Arlington with his brother, he that train ride, I've got all the pictures, and the crowds were white and black, and I don't know who today can do that. I mean, the white working-class guys with their salutes, the ex-military guys, you can tell with their whole families lined up regimentally. Nothing. That kind of patriotic belief in a guy like Bobby, I don't know if we have it anymore, where it's all tied into patriotism. I think it helped that the Kennedy brothers all fought in World War II, where they tried. One was killed in the war. One was nearly killed. They were such gung-ho patriots, such gung-ho anti-communists later on, that it was easy for working-class people of every side to say, yeah, they're one of us. And they weren't lefty intellectuals. They were not that. They were not elitists. They're not part of that world. And they were just different. They weren't like the Clintons or something today. They weren't divisive that way. They were more like part of the people. And I think that he would have really tried to unite black and white, because that's what he was doing at the end. He would drive around in Gary, Indiana, a city of old ethnic people, Eastern Europeans, where the blacks were moving in, and there's all the usual things that go on in that kind of situation. And he'd drive around the car with Tony Zale, the former middleweight champion who had beaten Rocky Graziano. And he drove around the car with him on one side and Mayor Hatcher, the first black mayor, on the other side of him. He would really try to display unity in a way that sounds almost hokey. But he's the only guy I know who's ever tried to do it. He really tried to unite black and white in the same. He wouldn't accept the fact that he was going to be for the steel worker and against the black kid in the ghetto. But he's going to be for both. And he said, why are you guys fighting? You've got the same interests. I mean, it sounds romantic, but that's who he was. He was trying to unite people.
Chris, thank you so much. I love the book. It's a real treat to talk with you. We appreciate
it. Thank you for reading it. I mean it. Thanks so much.
All right. Bye-bye now.